Hi everyone, today is September 14th, 2017. Welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's neuroscience podcast. So today's a special day. We just had our Neural Codes of Navigation Symposium, and we're doing our panel discussion today, and we're actually doing it behind closed doors, so it may be a little less chaotic for our listeners. I'm going to pass around. We have a great panel, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves, starting with you, Isabel.
Isabel Mucio from UTSA.
Dave Reddish from University of Minnesota.
Charlie Wilson, UTSA.
Andre Fenton, NYU.
Jim Kinnearum, Johns Hopkins.
Okay, so we just had a great symposium, and there's so much to talk about, of course, and I just want to start with this idea of navigation. It's such a rich field, and that's really reflected in the work of all of you guys. And all of you have variously talked about navigation as both behavior and as a neural computation. And I thought maybe you could say something about using either the behavior as a starting point for understanding the operational needs of navigation, and then using those to deconstruct the neural computation or the neural representations, versus starting with neural representations of spatial information and then how they are encoded and adjusted by then behavior. And sort of, because those approaches are both clearly out there and they have merits, and just how you guys feel about those two vantage points.
I think it's important to remember that behaviors can be accomplished by multiple computations. And therefore, unless you actually have a very careful theory with very careful kind of specific predictions to predict probe tests, the seeing a behavior alone doesn't tell you what the computation is, and that you can actually get what looks like superficially identical behaviors through very different computations that have to be broken apart. I think it's important to be working back and forth between those two carefully.
I would even add to that that when we conceive of this, one typically imagines that the computations give rise to the behavior, but in reality, the behavior itself is feeding back into the neural system that's actually accomplishing those computations. And so there's really no place to begin, if you will, this circle, right?
Right.
You have to study them in tandem and in careful tandem.
So how do we think about that? Are the cognitive spatial maps leading the behavior or trailing it? I mean, because there is an element of prediction involved. How are we sort of getting at some of that with data, with actual data?
Before we get there, I actually want to follow up what Andre said, actually, something I think is really important, which is that a lot of what we've learned about computation has come from behaviors for which that computation is not necessary. And I think that there's a common belief that in order to study a computation and behavior, the computation has to matter. There's this big push about causal manipulations, which are very important. But most of what we learned about the computations of maps and place cells came from the most trivial behaviors that does not need a hippocampus. But that was very important for understanding that. I think that's an important point when we talk about that interaction.
It's important, and I fully agree. For years, my lab has never done anything more complicated than training a rat to run in circles. And now we're doing more complicated things, and it's hard. But people have always been, especially students, they come in, oh, they want to do this and that. And I tell them, look, place cells, I guess they were discovered, Keefe had the animals doing kind of spatial tasks, but not all that complicated.
Not the original one.
The original, right?
The 71 paper.
Oh, that was just
the animals sitting in a box turned around basically.
Right, right.
Right, that's where place cells originally come from.
But certainly grit cells were discovered just with animals doing this
free
foraging behavior, if you want to call it foraging. But the same thing, and you make all these great discoveries. I think there's something to be said for studying these cells when they are necessary, because but that tends to be at kind of the next level in a way. So if you have two theories about what these cells are doing, or two or point with some certain kinds of computations, and it's critical for one behavior that depends on computation and not the other, well, then that kind of the way to evidence is that it's probably
right.
The first way is more appropriate to think about it, but it's totally true what you're saying, that you don't need to be having a behavior that's quote hippocampus dependent in order to study place cells and get very fine scale information about what they're doing.
I agree completely. I do think that a lot of the more complicated kind of second and third order effects that we've started to see in place cells have come because people have started looking at
exactly.
more complicated, you know, behaviors. But as you say, you know, you got to walk before you can run.
Yeah.
So can I ask a question about kind of historical? So it seems to me that place cells started out as just a receptive field. And Jim was saying, you know, he'd been a visual system scientist before, and there was just a sort of notion that a receptive field is a place where the light would make this cell fire, a place in space where the light would make this cell fire. And now the place field is just a place in space where the place would make the cell fire. But you guys have taken place cells away from that. It's not really a
Place cells. So historically, I don't think that any of the people actually studying place cells. I'm going to be careful not. I'm going to make a claim. This is before our generation. But my understanding is that even the earliest data, they knew place cells weren't merely visual cues. That was.
So I didn't mean visual. I meant spatial receptive field.
Well, but that's an issue. That's an issue because when I was a postdoc and Jim and I were postdocs together, one of the big things is our postdoctoral advisor, Bruce McNaughton, would never let us say, at least I don't know if you, I used to call them tuning curves. And I to this day say this is tuned to place. It's a tuning curve to place. But Bruce got very insistent not to call them tuning curves. And I think it's because historically, when they called them tuning curves, people were confusing them as simple sensory receptive cells,
right.
And they're fundamentally not.
That's right.
They're a computation that depends on both internal and external signals.
And they're fundamentally internal dynamics is what
right.
drives, that's the whole idea about the path integration, is that it's, if you put me in a sensory deprivation chamber, I think my hippocampus would still fire in ways similar to what they do normally,
right.
Because it's the primary drive are the internal dynamics of the brain, and the external landmarks are or external cues are there to adjust this. And this is a change in how systems neuroscience thinks about the brain overall. Well, you know, the idea about a receptive field that comes from the Hugo Beisel and Mountcastle and early sensory. Barlow and all those guys that it's all very passive in a way. It's sensory input drives these responses, and now we're in a totally different view of how the brain works. That the brain is always chugging away doing internal dynamics, and I think place cells and grid cells are probably, if not the best system to study those from the level that we're interested in terms of system dynamics and how it interacts with these external cues.
And maybe that's why it was never found that there is some kind of topographic organization for the place field, which you find in all the sensory systems.
The early experiments from the Muller-Kubi group were explicitly designed to refute that way of looking at these.
You mean the sensory?
Yes, to refute
right.
the sensory.
The sensory thing or
yes.
the space detection idea?
Both. In fact, I was similarly browbeaten out of calling these things tuning curves, because the question really was, how do you build a place field? Right? There was no explicitly asserted, there's no sensory epithelium, if you will, that you could follow from the outside world that could give you this kind of activity. That was an explicit assertion. And if you didn't understand that, it would be explained to you over and over and over and over again until you got it. Often with evidence, but certainly by belief and assertion. And that was the playground, if you will, in which I was certainly trained.
I do think the evidence, I mean, particularly, for example, the Jim's data, you know, Jim Knirum's data that we all talked about several times today, was really has definitively, you know, shown, as Jim says, that the internal comes first in the place fields, and that's now pretty, I think the evidence on that is rock solid at this point. And so now, in fact, I find that people do talk about tuned to place. And my understanding of the sensory motor world is that they've shifted now back to now to much more being like the place cell, kind of where there's internal dynamics and the sensory is modified, yeah, is modifying, yeah, an underlying internal dynamics. And that I think I agree with Isabel. It comes from the place cell sequence or history.
So can I just ask one more thing along that, and you can refute this too if you want to, but then one of the things that I thought when I first heard about this many years ago that I thought everybody was saying is that I know where I am by which place cells are firing in my brain. And today, when I heard you speaking, and I think I've been hearing this from other people for a little while, the place cells are often firing in a place to indicate a place that you are not a place that you are. Maybe a place you're going to, a place you're anticipating, yeah, or even, Andre told us about a place that you totally don't want to be. Right. And the place cells, mm-hmm, were telling you, in some sense, if you interpreted the place cells literally, you would think, that means I'm there. Mm-hmm. But that probably isn't what the place cells were intending to tell the animal at that moment.
But this is true of all the rest of the brain, too. I mean, imagination activates the same sensory areas. So you can't say that a visual cortex cell is telling you what you're seeing, because sometimes the visual cortex cell is telling what you're imagining about and you're not actually seeing, right? And it is true that there is a mechanism within the brain somehow to differentiate between imagined firing and real firing, because if you can't separate that, that's hallucination, right? But we know that in the sensory world, we have motor imagination. You know, all of these mirror neurons are essentially imagination neurons, right? So we know that all these other neurons also fire when you are processing things that are not necessarily immediately available.
So if we're switching back and forth really rapidly, and I think I saw something about that today too, between this cell representing one thing and a cell representing something else. Maybe we could switch very rapidly between a cell representing an imagined thing that I might, place I might be going, and the same cell maybe representing where I actually am. Who's distinguishing between those in the brain? Any ideas about that?
Well, I don't know who's distinguishing, but what one can think about this and not find too big a problem to solve, in one sense, in that in each case, we're really talking about how the brain builds an internal model of something called a place, which has certain properties, whether you happen to be there or whether you happen to imagine that place. It doesn't have to look fundamentally different from the point of view of the neurons that are realizing this. And so now we have the problem of how one recognizes somewhere within the system which version of this model it is. Is it a made-up model? Right? Is it a model that is simply reflecting what's somewhere in the external world? And here's where I think what we tend to see is that both components are present. And depending on the behavioral circumstances, or even within the same behavioral circumstances, dependent on, you know, internal choices like my, you know, will, if you will, or the animal's what decision it has come to, or what choices are before it, it can pick one versus another. And that's to me the really impressive thing. There is some way of making the distinction, because we see the consequence of that distinction.
Mechanistically, I don't think we know what that is. I mean, I think there are several possibilities that have been floated, things like internal oscillatory dynamics, changes in the ensembles, like Andre was talking about. Another structure could be kind of flagging a signal saying we're imagining now. But I mean, I'd be curious if any of the other panelists can, you know of data on this. As far as I know, there's no solid data on what that mechanism is. As Andre says, we know behaviorally it exists, right? Because we have both function and dysfunction in that recognition of imagination. But I don't think anybody has an answer yet to what that difference is.
I certainly don't, but I'm looking for
clues,
it.
Yeah, me too. Well, clues would presumably come from patients with different kinds of psychoses where they hear voices or these illusions, where these, presumably what's going on, these internal dynamics, which are interpreted normally as imagination or things, are actually heard as external
right.
voices. That would presumably be something, a breakdown of this system. So,
and it's in schizophrenia, at least it seems to be decoupling of frontal cortices.
Yeah. So it might just be a single area. This could be at levels that we're talking about, not within a certain area or as a mechanism. It's the coordination among brain areas, and I think one even has to be careful about how you pose the question, Mike. The hippocampus tells you where you are. I mean, this is one thing, we all talk now, but what our advisors told us, don't ever say that. So what I ever tell my students is whenever I hear, the hippocampus tells you where the rat thinks it is, don't ever say that. We have no idea if that's true or not. You know, people say, just because you get a remapping of the hippocampus, it's like, suddenly the rat thinks it's in a new place. And like, well, no, I know the rat. Because remapping, I know the rat knows it's in the same place. It's not like just because the place have changed.
Hmm? Do you know that the rat's in the same place under a remapping? Isn't there behavioral evidence that under remapping, the behavior often acts as if it's, doesn't always act? I'm not 100% convinced of that.
Well, if I do a minute, well, in the Marcus experiments.
Right.
I was thinking
where
of Marcus.
Where the rat's running around and you change the behavior, and the place feels remapped. Now, maybe it's true that suddenly the rat thinks it's been magically transported to a new location. I would doubt that, and you would have to prove to me that that's it. But people talk about remapping as if it's a given that the just because when you change locations that causes remapping, that the converse is true, that a remapping means that somehow the rat thinks it's in a different location or it changed. And there's no good evidence. There's no evidence I'm aware of that's true, and I would be astounded if that is true. So what that means, though, is that that's not the right way to think about the hippocampus. The hippocampus is not the seat of the Descartes, you know, the person, the ego center, you know, that this is a computation that is being used by other brain regions and read out in ways to support behavior, but is not. It's not built just by reading out CA1 that is where the rat thinks it is. It's much more complex than that.
I also think that it's very dangerous to talk about one brain structure telling the rat.
Mm-hmm.
The rat is the brain, right? Unless we're going to actually buy into either a Descartesian point or a homunculus or something, you know, that at some level, what does it mean to know where you are? There's a representation of where you are that has behavioral outcomes, right? And the question of, you know, what does it mean to imagine something? Well, it means that the sensory cortices are reactivating this signal. That is imagination. It's not that the sensory cortices are telling, the person somehow. Those are the person. And there's, of course, lots and lots of evidence that, you know, the physicality of the brain, I mean, this is something I'm pretty sure everybody in the room is pretty comfortable with. But to be honest, a lot of the students that I see coming through, that's the biggest, I don't want to say stumbling block, it's not quite the right word. The biggest barrier to get over is to stop thinking dually and start thinking as this is just another language for it. And I think it's really interesting that we still keep falling back on that kind of dualistic language, even though I don't think any of us buys into it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the evidence is pretty compelling that it has to be abandoned.
Right.
If you take any complex system, pick your department or something like that, or a society, you wouldn't ask such questions of the society. Where's the culture? Where would you go to the banks to find the culture? Do you go to the museums to find the culture? Is it in the theaters? Right. Where is that? It's clearly in the interactions of all of these things. And if you were to manipulate one of them, it's very likely you will have consequences on the other. Maybe directly, maybe with some time delay. But it's very difficult in a complex system to identify, you know, the crucial center, if you will, the seat of the you know, at the pineal gland, if you want to go back to Descartes. I think we've abandoned that sort of thinking. And we haven't replaced it with an easy to understand, easy to talk about, easy to communicate alternative, but we know that we are looking for it.
The interesting thing is, though, we jump in my chart. Oh, how could you say that? We all know that too. But the interesting thing is that we slip into that mode of thinking, even though we all agree that exactly that none of us, I don't think, are Cartesian dualists. Yet we have to actively, you know. And we don't think about it in terms of our systems, but often talk about other systems, we fall into that, and we have to train students not to think that way about our system. It kind of just shows how ingrained it is.
There's
to
a big
think about,
idea
about it, yeah, that this is a that somehow there's something magical about these cells, and that's,
and it adds to the complexity that the more we know about them, the more complex it gets, because now we know that even within place cells, even within a subregion, there is so much heterogeneity, and you have superficial cells and deep cells, and depending on the inputs, whether they are in the proximal distal axis or the dorsoventral axis, they have different properties. So it's more about understanding, probably at some level, the microcircuitry. And all the projections and inputs of any given cell in combination with other factors, the state of the animal and so many other things, that it's a very complex picture. So maybe looking at the problem as a whole is more important than trying to pinpoint the root or the specific function.
It's always a question of how does that heterogeneity translate across, strains and species,
mm-hmm.
and how consistent is it? Even if it's consistent within a strain of an animal, is it consistent within the species? And what are the consequences of those complexities,
mm-hmm.
In the behavior? I definitely think, and the other thing is, of course, that there's a dynamics to it that we tend to ignore. That within any, even the effect of one neural structure talking to another neural structure can change from moment to moment because of phase dynamics. I mean, Andre had that great example of, riding the wave in the surf, which I really want to steal this from my class. But it really, where those moments are in the oscillations, mm-hmm. coming in and out of phase, can have dramatic effects that are invisible at the anatomical level. And that adds to the complexity.
Right.
One of the things that I pray for, I'm not religious, is that within this complexity, there's actually a bunch of simple rules. And one of our problems is we're treating things that are by their functional anatomy, at least, and how they've been wired, are distinctive. That's what the heterogeneity means. And we're treating them as if they're the same. And so given the limited tools that we have today, we don't have a choice about that. But we're developing better and better ways of looking at these cells. And ideally, I think one of the things we all talked about today was our at least intention of looking for not a description of all the details of any particular system, but the sufficient details to recognize what it is canonical and fundamental, if you will, to make inferences and to drive understanding across navigation, across memory, across decision, because there's an underlying, I have to call it, you know, belief or fantasy, right? That's the goal, that at least at the level at which we're operating now, that there are common fundamental features across all of these what would appear to be distinctive psychological domains, but they're really at the neural level implemented in some set of common ways. And that I certainly am trying to pursue exactly that.
I've been dealing with a lot of kind of the balance between the neuroscience and the psychology level, and I've really learned to appreciate the concept of the construct, and that a lot of the question is finding the right construct to talk about the question, right? And so I found, for example, that talking about things in terms of constructs of information processing has become much easier than some of the circuit level constructs. You know, but what are the right constructs for us to be playing with? I was having a discussion with somebody about, you know, why is neuroscience so hard? And I said, well, part of it's because we don't know what the right constructs are. And he says, yeah, physics is easy. And I'm like, that's because physics is settled on momentum is useful and zodiac is not. But at one time, they were looking at zodiac of your birth date as a construct. And another time, they were looking at momentum as a construct. We kind of dropped zodiac because it's not a useful construct. And so one of the things that I wonder now is, you know, what are the right constructs for us to be talking about in the neuroscience level? And I think that's a lot of what the debate is happening right now is, I mean, as Andre said, what's the shape of the regularity that we can talk about?
To me, what's exciting about that is I feel that certainly across the time I've been in the game, there's a recognition of the constructs that we currently have aren't going to get us there. And so we're in that middle period where we're casting about, and maybe we're starting to settle on some things. There's certainly some candidates, but we definitely aren't there, but we're a long way from where I started, which was we kind of knew how to talk about this, and if you didn't talk about it this way, you know, you were out.
Your professor would tell you, don't ever talk about it like that.
But I do think, on the other hand, you know, one of the things we saw today in the symposium was how we've all converged on similar results and similar constructs, even though we weren't actually working on what we thought were the same thing. Right? I mean, this is something that always amazes me when, you know, we come up and we say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to run this experiment this way, and somebody else says, yeah, I ran my experiment that way, and we come up with the same answer. There's been a remarkable level of convergence in this field over the last, we're going to admit how old this, you know, the four of us are, but, you know, the last 30 years.
We don't have to talk about how old we are, but
how long we've been in the game.
And so that, to me, is the interesting thing, right? The data are pointing to very similar features or phenomena. What we haven't quite figured out yet is what words to attach to that to communicate the meaning.
So what are we talking about? Data. What are some of the commonalities that you guys are finding amongst the different branches all sort of coming together?
Well, for example, we can look at the point of local versus non-local representations, right? For example, the point that on certain phases of the theta cycle, right, which when an animal is paying attention to the world, the hippocampus, of course, shows this kind of 7 to 10 hertz rhythm, which is during which you have this kind of representations of local and non-local information. And the fact of when the oscillations, these sub-oscillations occur that give you local and non-local information, we're finding convergence on at least half a dozen labs doing very different experiments on actually different species, different strains of animals, and they're coming up with similar results of when is it representing, you know, we're talking about imagination, when is it representing the location of the animal, and when is it representing some non-current location of the animal that is somehow also important to the animal?
Right. We can recognize that from the local field potential features. What word I attach to that? Is that imagination? Is it recollection? Is it planning? I don't know what the right words are, but certainly a number of laboratories have pointed to that same thing as having those attributes.
So is it just about coming up with a language, a new common language, and how does that happen? Because we've seen this come up, this idea of naming something and how that sort of determines outcomes in a field before. And how do you imagine, I mean, you were the guys or who were doing the coining here, right?
Well, we have to talk about it in terms of, not in terms of psychological constructs, as if there's a one-to-one mapping between a property or a behavior that you might study at a cognitive level or a whole animal behavior level and expect, oh, we're going to see a correlate of that in the brain, that's where it's done. I mean, we're going to have to talk about the circuits as they are, that they're doing some specific function, some computation. They're getting inputs, computing them, and getting outputs. And then somehow that information is being sent to different parts of the brain under different circumstances, perhaps being routed to different regions based on oscillations. So this idea that during the slow gamma is hippocampus communicating with CA3, when they're coherent in slow gamma, when they're coherent in fast gamma, that's making the interaction with the entorhinal cortex stronger. And then presumably entorhinal cortex has relationships with other parts of the brain, and somehow at this level of interacting brain regions is what's giving the final behavior. But that's not saying that the hippocampus is doing this, or even that these gamma cycles are doing this. And so we have to think about what is the gamma cycle? Well, what its job may be doing is just a way of routing information and having two brain areas be more consistent or robust in its communication with each other and coordinating the temporal dynamics of interchange of information between these areas to do in the service of some computation, but that computation can be applicable to many different psychological processes or behaviors. And I think the trick a physiologist has for that is understanding that, because the same cell or the same brain region can have phenomenologically very different response properties, the response correlates that you think are completely different. And there was the example I gave at one part of the talk, maybe at the end, was it appears that in the hippocampus system, under certain conditions, these cells can appear like they're encoding time. In other conditions, they appear they're encoding distance traveled. And another condition, it appears they're encoding space. Now, time, distance, and space, phenomenologically, are completely different variables. And you might think, oh, what's going on here? This makes no sense. But when you look at the computational point of view, they can all be tied together at that point. It's the same circuit. When you change the nature of the inputs, the outputs of the computation, of course, change, but it's the same circuit, it's the same computation. That's what you have to understand. And I think that's, again, easier said than done, but that is, I think, the level that we have to look at these and understand that when we stick our electrodes there and get these neural responses, that's all they are. It's too easy to go from a neural response and say, oh, that's a neural representation.
I'm not even sure that the response is the right word.
Okay,
which is I was visiting a place somewhere, I forget, it might have been Oregon, and I was talking to one of the other people there going around, and we were talking about stuff, and then he asked me, well, he was a molecular neuroscientist, and he goes, I never understood you guys, when you talk about neural representations, how is that different from a neural response? And I said, well, and I had to think about it. and the difference is that a neural response or an activity of a neuron
tied to some independent variable. That's all that is. You can't say that that neuron is representing that unless, absent some theory of what that part of the brain is doing and what is the role of that. Otherwise, neural correlate, neural schmorlate. That's why people say all the time, I got a neural correlate of X. That doesn't mean anything.
I think the key is really talking about theory. Because fundamentally, the key is that if you want to talk about something like what is the brain actually doing and how does the brain do it, you need a way of connecting these different levels from the molecular to the cellular to the systems to the psychological to the behavior. And I would argue that a lot of the psychological processes, these psychological constructs, are translatable into not neural circuitry, but neural processes that interact across circuitry in specific ways. But you've got to have specific, concrete, theoretical statements that you can connect between these. And I think too often we take trivial statements pretending they are not theoretical when what they actually are is theoretical, right? The statement like, the hippocampus tells you where you are actually contains a huge amount of theoretical baggage that has to be unpacked. And when you unpack it, it becomes less and less viable, right? But if instead you talk about the computation of hippocampus as taking certain aspects of inputs with these kinds of representations, and these representations on these tasks do this thing, and on those tasks do those things, and now you have connections between these that are doing these computations in specific ways, these things become theoretical at a level where we can make quantitative, qualitative, and quantitative predictions. And one of the things that's been, Andre was talking about kind of how things have changed over the last 20 years or more, I've been shocked at how often these theoretical statements have actually come out and been tested and found to be true in ways that really, I have to say, shocked me.
So you're hearing us fumble, if you will, with language, because I think we don't have agreement on what that theory is. One concept that was in all of our talks today, and I think certainly governs how I think about things, is this notion of an attractor system or a competitive network, a system that is self-organizing, will, in the presence and or absence of any particular set of inputs, generate a organized, recognizable output that's non-random and actually deterministic in many ways. And there's a neural architecture that goes with that. The details we can fight about, but there are some general principles of global or a pervasive inhibition, cells that tend to fire together or tend to represent the same thing, happen to either get similar inputs or are mutually excitatory, that kind of thing. My intuition is if we build our thinking in some way in that sort of mechanistic theoretical framework, at least we can start to evaluate our distinctive kinds of experiments from that lens to understand, are we talking really about the same kinds of mechanisms? And if we, by luck or by genius, whichever way, I'm happy to go with the luck, if we happen to hit on the right way of framing that, then as a community, we actually can work together in building that thing that we're struggling right here to talk about.
So it seems to me like there's this real focus on like the canonical system functioning in an optimal way, and then people perturb a protein and create a disease state or try to model schizophrenia. But it really seems important to look at the extremes, how the system is built and how the system degrades with age. It seems like there are a lot of clues in there in terms of what happens to these representations. Like your work, Isabel, has shown that these place cells just, they don't crystallize the same way, I guess, in certain types of situations. Why is that? What connections are lost? Are the grid cells doing, is the input and the output, like what are the but the dynamics of that, right?
But the interesting part of that is that it was a specific situation when I was describing the animals were disoriented. Because if you look, as I was saying, if you look, for example, in age rats, the physiological differences with young rats are very minimal, and that's the work that Carol Barnes has done for years. There are not so many differences at the physiological level, including plasticity, play cells, yet at the behavioral level, you see these profound differences. So, again, how do you explain that?
This is one of those beautiful examples where, because we've actually did a lot, there was a lot of theoretical work that Carol and many other people were doing in those years, the very small changes that happen physiologically have predictable consequences because of the kind of things that Andre's talking about we know a lot about the circuits, we know a lot about the mechanism and about models, you know, computational models of those circuits that were able to then predict what would be the right probe trial to separate these very specific effects. And you look, you know, one of my favorite examples is Carol's 1997 paper, the multi-stability paper, where they actually took this very specific model of attractor dynamics, consequences of physiology that they had learned from slice work on changes in the LTP that happens with aged animals, and predicted that you would actually see multi-stability, which they then found in the remapping changing between young and old animals. And then from that, made a specific prediction as behavior. And then we're able to go back in because they have this wonderful database that they kept of all of their animals. They were able to go back to this huge database of behavior on the water maze and identify, honestly, a very surprising effect that completely changed how everybody had been thinking about behavior on the water maze. Right? And that was, again, it was one of these, that's a great example of a case where, you know, these specific changes are identifiable to a behavior because we had that theoretical stage. We had theoretical stages. And I don't want to give the impression that those theoretical stages are 100% right. I mean, theory is never right. It's almost sometimes useful, right? Isn't that the classic line, right? All theory is wrong. Sometimes it's useful, right?
It's useful when it's wrong.
Exactly. And that's actually another important point. But one of the things we often see, and I think this is the case, is the theory was in the right ballpark. And it was enough in the right ballpark to actually drive enough understanding to create new experiments that produce surprising results.
I'll add to that, what's particularly interesting about that example is, on the one hand, you can say, oh, we understand something about aging now, right? Or when I use a model that might be thought of as a schizophrenia model or an autism model or depression, or you can give it whatever name you want. Oh, we're learning something more about that disease state or dysfunction state. What's interesting, and in particular in my laboratory, why we use these animal models of dysfunction, is I'm actually trying to understand the normal system, but I don't know what to manipulate. And I'm using cues from the very rich clinical literature and the genetics that a lot of people are spending effort to identify that this is a factor that has some relationship. And we understand phenomenologically what aging looks like in this example. And so the study of the dysfunction not only taught us about the dysfunction state, but it actually allowed us to feel more confident about the theoretical underpinnings that built up the predictions in the first place. And so I'm a big fan of what can sometimes be called translational work, because it actually helps us understand the fundamental work also.
True enough.
I agree.
Funding agencies definitely agree. I feel like we could go on a couple more hours, but I'm going to have to cut it short, and you guys can continue over dinner. This has been so much fun. Thank you, Isabel Muzio, David Reddish, Charlie Wilson. Andre Fenton and Jim Kinnearum. I'm glad you pronounced your name first and not me. Thank you for joining us, everyone. This has been Neuroscientists Talking About.
It's been fun.